Good morning.
Good morning.
So, this morning I'm going to keep talking about case 3 of the Blue Cliff Record, Master Ma is Unwell, because last time I only got through the pointer. Here's the pointer to the case, which we talked about last week. One device, one object, one word, one phrase. The intent is that you'll have a place to enter. So this is just the one thing, the one moment, this time in your life, you'll have a place to enter into your life, enter into practice. One device, one object, one word, one phrase. The intent is that you'll have a place to enter still. This is gouging a wound in the healthy flesh. So in Zen talk, this is just saying you're saying too much, right? Because in Zen, we always like to say that. Just to say anything is saying too much. It can become a nest or a den. In other words, the teachings can become a way in which we actually don't face our lives. If you say too much, if you make too much of it, if it's applied in the wrong way, the great function appears without abiding by fixed principles. So this great function is life itself. So it's this way in which there are no fixed principles about how we engage this practice, and yet simultaneously there are principles in which we engage the practice. But they have to be flexible because they have to apply to your real life. They're not some kind of thing that we bring down from the mountain and never change. The intent is that you'll realize there is something transcendental. It covers the sky and covers the earth, yet it cannot be grasped. So it's something beyond our intellect. This way will do, not this way will not do. So we say, well, this way is the right way, not this way is the right way. This is too diffuse. In other words, it has to be applied to particular situations. It isn't some kind of abstract notion. This is too cut off. Or this way won't do, this way won't do either. This is too cut off. Without treading these two paths, what would be right? Please cite, please test. I cite this for you to see. So without going either of these ways, too much, not enough, this is right, this isn't right, without coming up with these fixed notions, what would be the right way? And so now he's saying, okay, I'm going to give you this case. I'm going to present this story, a koan, a story. So what's the story? The story is about the great Master Ma, who was unwell. So Master Ma, very famous Zen master, he's not feeling well, he's in bed, he lives in a monastery, he's the abbot in all likelihood, so great Master Ma is unwell. The temple supervisor or manager, he asked him, he said, "Teacher, how has your venerable health been in recent days? How has your venerable health been in recent days?" And the great master said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." That's very helpful. So what does that mean? Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. So that's what I want to talk about today. So Master Matsu, in Japanese his name is Basho Doitsu. He lived in the 8th century. This text was written around the 10th century, 11th century. And so it's probably, this is not exactly the way the story happened. It's been refined over the years. So there are a lot of these koans about Matsu. Sun-faced Buddha means, in Japanese, is Nichimen Butsu. And it means that a sun-faced Buddha lives for 1,800 years. Moon-faced Buddha lives for one day and one night. So we have two extremes. We have essentially the eternal, and we have a finger snap, just a moment. So these are these two extremes, right? So we have these two extremes. We can say likes and dislikes. We can think about anything that's like that. So when he says to Master Ma about this, he asks him about it. He says, "Well, I'm not the Sun-Faced Buddha. I'm not attached to being well, and I'm not Moon-Faced Buddha. I'm not attached to not being well." So he doesn't say, we like to say, "Oh, Sun-Faced Buddha is better than Moon-Faced Buddha." Right? Somebody asked us, "Well, which is better?" You say, "Oh, it must be Sun-Faced Buddha." But actually, it's not Sun-Faced Buddha and it's not Moon-Faced Buddha. It's just reality itself. So reality itself holds both of those things simultaneously. Reality is at the same time Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha. At one time we say, "Oh, Sun-Faced Buddha." Another time we say, "Oh, Moon-Faced Buddha." But what happens to the other one when this one comes forward? Where does the other one go? So when you think about your own life and you think, "Oh man, this is great, this is great." What happened to the "this is not great"? And when things are "this is not great," what happened to "this is great"? Or if you say to yourself, "Wow, I really messed that up." Sometimes we say to ourselves, "I am so bad." But what happened to the part of you that is so skillful? What happened to the part of you? Where did that part go? Because that part is still present. So in the moment of Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha is still present. So when we're really happy or we're feeling well, it's usually not a problem. We don't think about it, right? It's just like, "Hey, this is cool." We just take it for granted. Although as we get older, we tend to take that less for granted, right? It's like you wake up in the morning, ugh. So, but when we're feeling this way in which it's Moon-Faced Buddha, then it's a real problem for us. It's a real problem. So I think it helps for us to remember that the other side didn't go away. The other side didn't cease to exist. So we have these two extremes. So we know from the pointer of the koan that we talked about last week, we know this koan is about not getting caught in one extreme or the other. And this is true universally for anything that we can turn into two polarized or dualistic points of view. Anytime you find yourself caught on one kind of thinking about something, the other is simultaneously present. So if we're way over on this side, we need to consider the possibility that we might be a little off balance, right? There's Ajahn Chah supposedly said that his job as a teacher was to sit under a tree, and as the students walked down the path, he would go a little to the right. No, now a little to the left. So this is what we want to do. We want to be aware of Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha. We want to be aware of that and say to ourselves, "Oh, a little to the right, a little to the left." Or, of course, that's why we have teachers, too. We go to our teacher and we say, "I hate this person." Except usually we know that that's not cool. So we don't say, "I hate this person." We say something that's maybe not as radical. But we say, "Oh, I'm having this really hard time. This person did this thing. I'm really angry with him. And so our teacher says, "Well, have you considered it, thought about it this way? Have you thought about what it's like from the other person's point of view? Have you thought about your attachment to having it your own way?" Or maybe the teacher says, "Oh, why don't you go sit zazen and just be really angry with yourself?" Like, feel that anger, you know, just sit there and stew in that and then realize how incredibly uncomfortable it is to sit and stew in these emotions that you're having. And then you might say, "Oh, this is suffering. This is suffering. Like, maybe I might want to do the practice so I don't have to suffer so much." So the practice isn't getting rid of, but the practice is being present for. The practice is being a willingness to sit in the midst of being a human being, to sit in the midst of Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha. So Master Ma is saying, I am sitting, I am being in the midst of unwell. I am being in the midst of well. I am being in the midst of neither well or unwell. Because he doesn't say one is better than the other. He just says sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha. This is a kind of equanimity. We know Master Ma's unwell, right? We know that he's probably suffering in some way. So let's say Master Ma has a flu. So, you know, Master Ma's got a fever, or Master Ma's got the chills, or Master Ma's just having a really, you know, not great day. But there's this way in which Master Ma has this willingness to be present for that with a mind of equanimity. So that's what he's conveying. So not having a fixed idea, not being attached to, not desiring it to be this way or that way, although of course we do want it to be this way or that way, because that's the human condition. It's like, we don't want to have the flu. So we say, and yet, I bet everybody here has had the flu or have a cold. And there's this way in which when we have, especially when we have a cold, we usually say, okay, I have a cold. It's not particularly pleasant. I don't particularly like it, but I have to go to work today. So I'll take some Kleenex with me and take some whatever, aspirin or whatever I'm going to take. And I'm going to work and I can figure that I'm going to have a somewhat unpleasant work day. Sometimes I'm going to totally forget I have a cold, and other times I'm going to be sitting around blowing my nose and I'm going to get all red, yada-da-da-da. So we have this expectation of what it's going to be like, and we're willing to be with that, to kind of be present for that. And part of the way that happens for us is because we've had a whole bunch of colds in our life. It's like it's a known thing. So there's this way of a kind of patience, a willingness to be present for that, a willingness to be with that. So as human beings, though, we do have likes and dislikes. We don't want to have colds. We don't want to get sick. We don't want to have people disagree with us. We don't want to have people pull out in front of us in traffic. Matter of fact, we don't want to have anybody else on the road with us. You know? We don't want anybody to be in line at the supermarket who seems to be having a problem with some coupon that they brought. Whenever I go to CVS, this seems to be a major thing at CVS. People always bring a lot of coupons there, and somehow there seems to be problems. So we don't want to stand in line while they do that, and we get impatient, and we look around, and we say, oh, are they going to open another line? Of course, we all know that if you leave the line that you're in to go to another line, then something's going to happen in which the line that you were in is the better line. The universe is teaching us equanimity. The universe is teaching us patience. They're saying, stay in that line. Don't get out of that line. I mean, that sounds like just a silly, funny example. But in a way, it teaches us that the suffering is not the line itself. The suffering is our ideas about the line. The suffering is all the impatience that's coming up for us. So this willingness to just say, okay, I'm going to let go. I'm going to accept the fact that something's happening in this line. I don't know what it is. It's okay. You know, appreciate the fact that the clerk is taking the time to actually help that person. And how nice it would be if that was our situation, if we were in the front of the line. So cultivating this equanimity. So this brings up the question of acceptance. Master Ma is accepting of his situation. So often, again, when we talk about acceptance, we go to extremes. We go to the extreme in our mind of, does that mean that we accept anything? Does that mean that anything that happens around us is okay? So this often comes up around when we see things that we feel like are immoral or wrong. People say, well, should I just accept that? Should I accept sexual harassment? Should I accept that? That's big right now. And the answer is no. No, we don't accept that. No, we don't accept something that we think is morally wrong. But then the question is, how do we act? How do we act in a skillful way? How do we respond in a way that's helpful? And every situation will, in all likelihood, dictate what that might be. And yet, simultaneously, there's this way in which skillful means comes from our acknowledgement that we are all in this together, our acknowledgement that we are all human beings, our acknowledgement that we don't want to go to these extremes, that it's probably not helpful to hate someone who's doing something immoral. You may hate what they do, but to actually hate the person themselves is probably not helpful. So how do we make those distinctions? How do we respond in that way? So those are questions that we have about what it is to accept something, what it is to say, yes, I'll accept this. But I think far too often we really fight and rail against things, like, for example, standing in the line in the supermarket. Why not accept that? Why not be okay with that? Because in that situation, that's a place for us to learn to be patient. It's a place for us to learn equanimity. It's a place for us to drop our suffering. So we look for those places. We pay attention to the things that are happening in our lives that are annoying us, that are upsetting us, and say, is this a time when really I could just take a really deep breath and just accept this just as it is? Also, we can accept things and at the same time want to change things. We can accept things and at the same time take action to respond to that situation. So that's another possibility. So the only way we know what that possibility is to actually be present for that particular thing that's happening and ask ourselves, what's the right response here? What's the response that will help me to alleviate my own suffering and the suffering of other people around me? So Master Ma is saying, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, this way in which he's willing to be both simultaneously. He's willing to be present for both at the same time. So how do we do that? How do we do that? There is a young man named Aaron Lee. So I wrote this in my weekly quote last week. Aaron Lee was Asian American Buddhist, and he wrote a blog called Angry Asian Buddhist. And so Mr. Lee was unhappy about what goes on, I guess, in the American Zen community in relationship to Asian Americans and various things like that. I'm not exactly sure, to be honest with you, what exactly he was upset about. But what's interesting to me was that he did a interview and he talked about he was ill and he since died. He died on October 21st and he talked about what was happening for him around that. He said, "The hardest part for me is that everything you have imagined and dreamed and hoped for in the future is tossed away," for getting this diagnosis of cancer that he's going to die. "It feels like the diagnosis has taken that away from you. That feeling of loss for me was the hardest. If you can bring yourself to the point when you can let go of some of those dreams and think about how you can be happy right now, that's what's important to me. That has given me a lot of freedom. I don't feel like I'm shackled by death. If death comes, it comes," he said, before adding with a laugh, "It will come, actually." So the last part, of course, is great because we're all going to die, right? That's like, I don't know anyone who skipped that part, you know? But mostly, if we're healthy, we don't think about that. We don't think about that so much. So this hardest part for me was that everything you have imagined and dreamed and hoped for in the future is tossed away. So basically, he is completely facing impermanence. He's facing the reality of this impermanent life that we live, but in a very visceral, present, right now way that most of us don't face moment to moment to moment to moment. And yet, he has a future. He's alive. The future is not tossed away, but it's not the future that he imagined that it would be. So there's this way of letting go of, and this is true for all of us. It's like we have an agenda, we have an idea about what we want to do, and sometimes it works out that way, and sometimes it doesn't work out that way. Sometimes it changes and we don't even think about it. We kind of just kind of go with it. And sometimes it changes and we have to think about it, and we really are brought up short. And we're looking at things in a totally different way, and we're railing against it, and we're fighting against it, and it's difficult for us. And so again, that's that edge. You know, when do we make that effort? How do we make that effort? What is that effort that we're going to make? Is it, how are we going to change and meet the impermanence of our life? How are we going to change and meet the impermanence of this moment and this moment and this moment and this moment? When we drive our cars, we're meeting the impermanence of every moment changing. We're making decisions every moment that we go down the road. And we, for the most part, we don't even think about it. For the most part, we're just responding. And then something happens, somebody does something we don't like, and bang, there it is. In some ways, and this is maybe sounds very trivial, but in some ways, that's tossed away our future, our preconceived idea about how that was supposed to happen, just got shattered in that moment. So what do? We have to work on it on this level. We have to work on it at a level that's very doable for us, so that when things, really big things happen, we have those tools, we have that foundation for us to be able to respond to our life. Otherwise, we have nothing, we're at sea, we're drowning. So that we really, Buddhist practice really asks us to pay attention right now, not in some abstract way. So here, Aaron Lee is faced with his death. He's faced with this diagnosis. And he feels like all the ideas that he had about his future, he was 34 years old, all the ideas he had about his future was completely tossed away. So I'm sure he must have felt great despair. He must have felt defeated. He must have felt somewhat at sea. And yet he turned back to his practice. He says, that feeling of loss for me was the hardest. If you can bring yourself to the point where you can let go, right? Let go of the ideas that you had about what was going to happen. And just really be present for your life as it is right now. This is such a basic Buddhist teaching. It's so difficult to do, this letting go. This letting go, because it's really hard. Again, it requires discernment. We can't just let go of everything, right? Our lives are not about just letting go of everything, every idea we have. It's not about letting go of every intention we have. But it is asking us to say, is this... It is asking us to say, what is it? What is it right now? What is my life right now? What is the most important thing? What is it that I want to hold on to? What is it that I want to let go of? He says, think about how you can be happy right now. That's what's important to me. So this way in which when we face death, physical death of this body and mind, when we face that, we ask ourselves, what is the most important thing? And I think in our daily lives, when we don't have to face this, we forget about that. We don't ask what the most important thing is, because we're just going through our day, you know, being tripped up by little stuff. I'll tell you a story about Jocko and I. We're at the doctor's office. And this is kind of funny. I mean, embarrassing perhaps in a way. She and I, Jocko and I were like, the doctor said, well, would you like to take some paper tape? And I said, well, we've got some in the house. She said, no, we don't. doctor says, no, we don't. And I said, well, yes, we do. And the doctor says, hey, you know, really? Just take the tape. So our Buddhist teacher. Isn't this the kind of stuff we do?
Yeah.
The silly stuff we do? Oh, we've got some. No, we don't. Yes, we do. Who cares? What difference does it make? Just take the tape. You know? Because that those moments of yes, no, I yes, you're right, I'm right, you're wrong, that's suffering. Those moments are moments of suffering. The deeper truth is that we really care about each other and love each other, so who cares about the tape, right? So there's this way in which that we try to come back to what's the most important thing. What's the most, the deepest thing? Suzuki Roshi used to say, what is your inmost request? Mm-hmm. What's your vow? You know, what is the thing that deeply motivates you? What is your inmost request? So we say the Bodhisattva vow, this vow, we want to benefit all beings. But in some ways, that's way too abstract, you know. So what is your deepest intention? Is it to be compassionate in your daily life? Is that your deepest intention? Is it to work on not feeling angry or work on not being greedy or whatever it is? You know, what is it that you most want to do in your life? And then to say to yourself, how can I apply this to the difficult times in my life? If what I most want to be is to work on compassion, then why am I so bothered by my neighbor, you know? So this way that we really take that inmost vow and apply it to the things that are difficult in our daily lives. When we do that, we start to find gratitude. Gratitude, acceptance, a willingness to be accepting of the other person. So let it go, you know, that it's not important. So this, Aaron Lee is forced to look at this. You know, this is like really this deep place, which essentially we all face, but it's more abstract. Each moment is birth and death. Shoji in Japanese, Dogen wrote Shoji, and Shoji in Japanese means birth, death, not birth and death. We like to think of it's birth, death, like two separate things. But birth and death is happening all the time. Each moment. We're dying all the time. We're living all the time. We're being born all the time. So those things are happening simultaneously. Sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha. So in the midst of that, we can't pay attention to that 24/7. But our whole body is doing that. The whole world is doing that. We could not have life as we know it without that happening all the time. So how do we negotiate that? How do we do that? And I think, again, it's coming back to what is the most essential thing for us. He says, think about how you can be happy right now. Think about how you can be happy right now. And from a Buddhist point of view, and from many religions and many people, what we find about being happy right now is not going shopping. We usually find it in family. We find it in relationships. We find it in nature. Essentially, what we find it in is going back to this shoji, going back to this vibrancy, this reciprocity, this support, this interaction of our life that we find in relationship with beings. We find in relationship with nature, with people. So he says, you know, and when we do that, we don't feel shackled by death. He didn't feel shackled by death, knowing that he was going to die at some point much sooner than most of us think about our death. So this kind of freedom, this freedom that he experienced. So we have birth, death as one thing, which is alive. There's another koan. Is it alive or dead? So the master goes with his student to a funeral, and they're at the funeral, and the student goes up and he goes on the coffin. Like that. I know, it's outrageous. Then it's like, oh, he did. How rude. So the student goes up, he goes, oh, alive or dead? Knock, knock, anybody in there? Alive or dead? And they're leaving the funeral. The master and the student are walking back to the monastery, and the student and the master says, He says, well, I won't say. The student's like, alive or dead, alive or dead. The master says, I won't say, I won't say. The student says, well, I'm going to hit you if you don't tell me if it's alive or dead. He said, I just won't say, I won't say. So, because you can't say alive or dead. You can't say what that is. You know? This whole world is an enormous process, right? This process of life, this process of death, this process of regeneration and change and transformation, moment to moment to moment. So to remember that, we're being asked to remember that and to live that and to connect with that and make that a koan to ask ourselves, what is it? What is it? What's the most important thing? Suzuki Roshi said, when your mind is not restricted by restriction, that is what we mean by practice. When your mind is not restricted by restrictions. So there's this way in which we are restricted. Aaron doesn't have a choice. Aaron Lee had no choice here, alive or dead. Ultimately, we all have no choice, alive or dead. But he was facing this no choice, alive or dead. That's the restriction. That's the restriction that we face. This restriction of our likes and dislikes. This restriction of being a human being. So this way in which Suzuki Roshi is saying the practice is not being restricted by restriction. That's the practice. So in Zen, we say, well, just eat. Just sit. Just sleep. Just eat, not being restricted by restriction. Just sit, not being restricted by restriction. Just sit zazen even though you don't want to sit zazen. The don't want to is the restriction, and not being restricted by the restriction is, oh, it's time to sit zazen, so I will go to the zendo and sit zazen. I will sit here for 40 minutes or 20 minutes or however long it is until the bell, and I would not be restricted in that activity by my restrictions of not wanting to do the activity. I will get up in the morning and go to work. Because when you get up every morning and go to work and you're like, I don't want to go to work, I don't want to go to work, I don't want to go to work, well, you're suffering. So your restrictions are restricting your happiness, because you can't come to terms with your restrictions. So Suzuki Roshi is saying, don't be restricted by those. Don't be obstructed. Don't be obstructed by your obstructions. Because to be a human being is to be obstructed. So how is it that we are not obstructed by our obstructions? And I would suggest to you, from my point of view as a Soto Zen teacher, the way that we do that is through our practice. And the way we do our practice is that it's like learning anything. It's like being a dancer. So when you're a dancer, you have to learn how to dance, right? Or if you're an artist or whatever it is that you do, first you have to learn how to do what you're doing. So first we have to go and learn how to do the practice. We learn the practice, we learn the forms, we learn those things, and we have faith that in that learning, something transformative is happening. So we do it, and we do it, and we do it, and we do it, and we get to know ourselves through the doing of that doing. And then at some point, we forget about that. And we let, as we say in Zen, we'll let the doing do the doing. We let the sitting sit sitting. We let eating eat eating. We let the restrictions restrict the restrictions without any restrictions restricting the restrictions, right? So there's this way in which we just... But we have to learn how to walk. First we have to learn how to do the thing that we're doing. So we do the formal practice. We also do our own personal practice in the midst of that too. So that personal practice is, what is it for you? Is it driving down the street? Is it standing in line? Is it going to work? Is it dealing with your neighbor? What is that? What is that thing that catches you? What is that thing that's a problem? What are the things? I don't know anybody who's only got one. What are the things that catch us up? And then, of course, that's why we have teachers. We go to our teachers and we say, oh, yeah, I'm caught. And the teacher says, well, you could do this, or you could do this, or you could do this. Some teachers say, do this. So there's this way. And sometimes you do what your teacher says, and sometimes you don't. I was really bad. So sometimes you do it, and sometimes you don't. But there's this way in which we need that outside input, right? Because sometimes we can't see things. It's hard to do this by yourself. It's really hard to do most things by ourselves. So we just do this practice, and then we let practice, practice, practice. Then we just let it take its form and do, be itself. Ourselves, be ourselves. We find the inmost vow. And we let that be the motivating factor in the midst of not being restricted by our suffering. Thank you very much.